Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you 7 days a week to help you learn and improve your American English skills. At the same time, we tell you about interesting and important events from around the world. Today, we will hear from a group that loves animals. They say that something good may come from the recent killing of a famous lion in Zimbabwe. Then, information about a product that was once illegal all over the United States, but is now making a lot of money in some places legally. If you are ready to listen and learn, let's get started with part one. The head of the animal rights group Born Free USA says the recent killing of Cecil the lion put a face on issues conservation groups have been addressing for years. Current campaigns aim to stop trophy hunting and cruelty to elephants in Africa. Kelly Jean Kelly is here to explain.
After an American hunter killed a beloved lion named Cecil in Zimbabwe this summer, animal rights are getting increased attention in the U.S. In September, a lawmaker from Arizona proposed a law that would prohibit importing dead animals that are threatened or endangered. The species do not have to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. The law would limit trophy hunting, in other words, hunting large and mature animals to display back home. Representative Raul Grijalva calls the proposed legislation the Conserving Ecosystems by Ceasing the Importation of Large Animal Trophies Act. The first words of the act spell Cecil, the name of the lion killed by an American dentist. The proposed law would have prevented the American hunter from bringing Cecil's body into the U.S. Adam Roberts is the CEO of the animal rights group Born Free USA. He says more than 500 lions are killed every year in Africa as trophies. When you take an individual like Cecil out of the family system and out of the ecosystem, it has dire consequences, he says. Another animal rights campaign is looking at organizations in southern Africa that offer elephant rides to tourists. Activists say using elephants for entertainment is cruel, inhumane, and dangerous to both humans and elephants. Kate Neustadt is the director of wildlife for the World Animal Protection Group, based in London. Ms. Neustadt explains that, for a long time, many people believed African elephants, which are larger than Asian elephants, could not be trained. But recently, she says, trainers have begun using techniques that can be effective but cruel. The elephants are taken, sometimes months old, from their mothers, Ms. Neustadt says, and when they're very young, juvenile elephants go through what's called the crush. And in this, they're trapped in a small cage, tied up with ropes so they can't move. And the trainers are poking them with sticks, hitting them with whips and wooden batons as well, until the elephant's spirit actually breaks. Many of the better-known tourist organizations say they use only positive training techniques. But Ms. Neustadt says even under the best training methods, no elephant enjoys giving rides or being in entertainment ever or anywhere. In addition, the U.S. Humane Society says trainers can use abusive methods to control elephants. They are often chained for many hours every day. They may also be prevented from having social contact with other elephants. And the U.S. Humane Society adds, elephants are unpredictable. They can unexpectedly act aggressively. They can also carry diseases such as tuberculosis. But these obstacles may not prevent humans from using elephants for profit. In Johannesburg, a 10-minute elephant ride costs about $35. That means a trained elephant can earn more in a day than the average South African. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Use of the plant marijuana remains illegal under U.S. federal law, but it has been legalized for medical or personal use in 23 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. This has attracted investors and created a boom for many businesses. Last year, almost $3 billion worth of the drug marijuana was legally sold in the United States. Investors and businesses in the marijuana industry met in Los Angeles last week. Products used in the cannabis or marijuana industry were displayed at the LA Convention Center. The products included fertilizers and hothouse lights. Those lights help grow the plant indoors. Companies were also selling devices that extract oils from the cannabis plant. Robert Burns works for the company Hemp Meds. He said his company offers cannabis creams for skin or drops of the oil that can be placed under the tongue. Let it sit there for about 30 seconds and just let it dissolve in your body that way, he said. Products like cannabis chocolate, marijuana-flavored wine, and cannabis sweets were also for sale at the trade show. The increase in marijuana sales is also a major business boom for companies that make packaging. Peter Tadlock is with AmeriVax, a company that makes vacuum packaging. That packaging keeps the product fresh for a longer time. He said his company gets orders from Washington State, Colorado, Florida, and California. Training courses were offered for people new to the cannabis industry. Michael Garcia attended one of the courses. He works for a small company that makes and sells vegan foods. He hopes to expand his line of products. I want to start putting marijuana in my food products because of the health aspects, he said. Kyle Turley is a professional American football player. He believes marijuana helps with sports-related injuries. He spoke at the conference and hopes to make marijuana use legal in sports. However,
Opponents of marijuana use say the long-term effects of the potent or strong marijuana sold today are still unknown. Some U.S. government officials do not support the spread of marijuana use. They consider it a gateway drug to more dangerous drugs. But for now, they are taking a hands-off approach, and the cannabis industry continues to grow.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Have you ever heard an English teacher say, "Teaching grammar is boring"? Betty Azar has, and she strongly disagrees.
For me, teaching grammar is the most fun class of all. I think that is a misconception, that teaching grammar is a boring thing to do. When teaching grammar, for me, always was the class I looked forward to the most, because grammar was just the foundation. It's where you started. Grammar's just a starting point.
Betty Azar is a world-famous expert on teaching English grammar. She talked with VOA about how teachers can move from grammar to communication experiences.
From there, you do conversations, you do games, you do communicative interaction. You do all the wonderful things you do in a second language classroom, but you do it in combination with having a solid foundation of the structures that they're using.
The common misunderstanding that Ms. Azar sees, teachers try to get students to memorize rules. Grammar is not just learning rules. It is a way to help students along the way to communication.
If you have a class named grammar, it doesn't mean you're teaching rules that the students have to learn. It just means grammar's where we're going to start, and then we're going to go have a lot of fun with it and practice and do a lot of interesting things. And most importantly, have successful communication experiences. Those are the building blocks of learning a second language.
The secret to communicative language teaching is to focus on understanding and being understood, according to Ms. Azar. Another piece of advice for teachers is that students do not all learn in the same way. Each may have a different learning style when it comes to learning grammar. Some may see a pattern and understand the rule. Others need explanations and more practice.
To teach grammar as a subject matter and test it as though you were testing the memorization of dates in history is sure to bore everybody and not reach the goals that you're trying to reach, successful communication experiences.
Because grammar was removed from the regular course of study in the U.S. and U.K. in the 1960s, most native speakers of English did not learn it in school. Ms. Azar imagines that many teachers are not comfortable teaching grammar because they do not know how to answer their students' questions. Betty Azar hopes that her textbooks help teachers learn to make the teaching of grammar fun. She says that her students enjoy learning grammar as much as she enjoys teaching it.
Students, in my experience, love it. I think grammar is absolutely fascinating, endlessly fascinating. It is the glue that holds language together. It is a many-colored, interwoven fabric that is really beautiful when you get to know it. Grammar is quite a remarkable thing.
I'm Jill Robbins.
From VOA Learning English.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. James K. Polk moved into the White House after his swearing in as the nation's 11th president on March 4, 1845. Polk told voters during the election campaign he would serve only one term as president. During those 4 years, he wanted to achieve or reach four main goals. Two of his goals related to money. Polk wanted to reduce taxes on imports and to establish an independent treasury. His other goals related to expanding the country to the Pacific Ocean. President Polk wanted to secure the Oregon Territory and California for the United States. Those who supported the president shared Polk's belief that the United States should extend from sea to sea, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. They felt it was God's will and their duty to spread American democracy and freedom across the continent. In the words of poet Walt Whitman, "It is for the interest of mankind that America's power and territory should be extended. The farther, the better." One way Americans wanted to extend the country was by making the Oregon Territory part of the United States. The territory included what are now the U.S. states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, as well as part of the Canadian province of British Columbia. American traders established claims to the Oregon Territory early in the country's history. But British explorers gave Britain claims to the same territory. The two countries could not agree on how to divide Oregon between them. Since few white settlers lived in Oregon, Britain and the United States agreed to occupy the area jointly. This joint occupation worked well until the 1840s. Then, thousands of Americans began moving west to Oregon. The new settlers wanted all of Oregon to belong to the United States. President Polk agreed. He thought the United States had strong claims to the entire territory, but he said he would compromise. He offered to divide Oregon at the 49th parallel of latitude. Everything north of this line would belong to Britain. Everything south of it, including the Columbia River, would belong to the United States. Britain's minister in Washington rejected the offer. He said Britain would accept nothing but the Columbia River as the southern border of British Oregon. President Polk said America had no choice then but to claim all of Oregon. He seemed to say the United States would fight, if necessary, to defend its claim. Polk did not really want war, but he thought he needed a strong position to negotiate with Britain. In London, the British government decided Oregon was not worth a war with the United States. After all, Britain had moved its trading center on the Columbia River north to Vancouver Island, so there was no real reason to demand rights to the use of the river. The British Foreign Minister proposed a treaty that would divide the territory at the 49th parallel of latitude. The proposal was almost the same that President Polk had made earlier. The United States accepted the proposal. The treaty made the 49th parallel the U.S. border from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. South of this was California. An American government minister once described California as the richest, the most beautiful, and the healthiest country in the world. The official said the port of San Francisco was big enough to hold all the navies of the world. He said someday San Francisco would control the trade of all the Pacific Ocean. There was only one problem.
It was owned by Mexico.
Historian Robert Mary wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Mary says Polk wanted to bring California into the Union anyway.
So obviously he had some underlying ideas about how that might be done.
At first, the United States attempted to buy California from the Mexican government. But Mexican officials refused even to talk about selling California to the United States. When the U.S. Congress approved statehood for Texas in early 1845, Mexico broke relations with the United States altogether. President Polk ordered the commander of the U.S. Army in Texas, Zachary Taylor, to move his forces into the disputed area near the Rio Grande River. The river formed part of the border between Texas and Mexico. Polk sent a representative to Mexico in an effort to reestablish diplomatic relations. But the Mexican government refused to talk with the diplomat. General Taylor sent one of his officers across the Rio Grande to meet with Mexican officials. The Mexicans protested. They said the area across the river was Mexican territory. The movement of American troops there, they said, was an act of war. For almost a month, the Americans and the Mexicans kept their positions. Then, on April 25, 1846, General Taylor received word that a large Mexican force had crossed the border a few kilometers up the river. A small force of American soldiers went to investigate. They were attacked. All of the Americans were killed, wounded, or captured. General Taylor quickly sent a message to President Polk in Washington. It said war had begun. Taylor's message arrived at the White House on May 9th. A few days later, the president asked Congress to give him everything he needed to win the war and bring peace to the area. Some members of Congress did not want to declare war against Mexico. They believed the United States was responsible for the situation along the Rio Grande. They were outvoted. Later, Polk wrote, "We had not gone to war for conquest, but it was clear that in making peace, we would, if possible, get California and other parts of Mexico." Many Americans opposed what they called Mr. Polk's war. Whig Party members and anti-slavery abolitionists in northern states believed that slave owners and Southerners in Polk's administration had planned the war. They believed the South wanted to win Mexican territory for the purpose of spreading and strengthening slavery. The president was troubled by this opposition, but he did not think the war would last long. He thought the United States could quickly force Mexico to sell him the territory he wanted. So Polk secretly sent a representative to the former Mexican dictator, Antonio López de Santa Anna. Santa Anna was living in exile in Cuba. The representative said the United States wanted to buy California and some other Mexican territory. Santa Anna said he would agree to the sale if the United States would help him return to power. President Polk accepted the deal. He ordered the United States Navy to to let the former dictator sail to the Mexican port of Veracruz. But once Santa Anna returned, he failed to honor his promises. He refused to end the war and sell California. Instead, Santa Anna organized an army to fight the United States. In 4 months, he built an army of 20,000 men. When General Taylor learned that Santa Anna was preparing to attack, he moved his forces to fight the Mexicans. Santa Anna sent a representative to meet with General Taylor. The representative said the Americans had 1 hour to surrender. Taylor's answer to Santa Anna was short. Tell him to go to hell. The battle between the United States and Santa Anna's army lasted 2 days. Losses were heavy on both sides. On the second night, the Mexican forces withdrew from the battlefield. Taylor had won. The victory strengthened Taylor's public image. He had already won the Battle of Monterrey, a major trading and transportation center in northeast Mexico. Other American forces also were victorious. General Winfield Scott captured the port of Veracruz and was ready to attack Mexico City. Commodore Robert Stockton invaded California and had raised the American flag over the territory. Stephen Kearny seized Santa Fe, the capital of New Mexico, without firing a shot. Still, the war was not over. President Polk's short war already had lasted for more than a year. Polk decided to send a special diplomatic representative to Mexico. He asked the diplomat to negotiate a peace treaty whenever Mexico wanted to stop fighting. A ceasefire was declared, but attempts to negotiate a peace treaty failed. Santa Anna used the time to prepare for more fighting. So General Scott ended the ceasefire. His men began their attack on Mexico City. The fighting lasted 1 week. Finally, the government of Mexico surrendered and Santa Anna left power. On February 2, 1848, the United States and Mexico signed a peace treaty. Mexico agreed to give up California and New Mexico, and Mexico would recognize the Rio Grande as the southern border of Texas. The war was officially over. But historian Robert Mary says President Polk suffered because of the conflict. The war with Mexico, Mary says,
ended up being a much longer war than he had anticipated and much more costly in terms of lives, in terms of money, and in terms of his political standing.
The war with Mexico also influenced the U.S. election in 1848. That election and the problem of what to do with the new territories will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.